friends. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. It's the Republic Broadcasting Network. And today is Saturday, July 16th, 2005. Got a great show lined up for you today. Going to be talking with Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. And also going to be talking with an assistant professor of political science at the University of Chicago by the name of Robert A. Pape, who's the author of the new book, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. That will be in the second hour. But first, let's go ahead and bring up Juan Cole. He is a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's the author of many books, including Colonialism and Revolution in the Middle East, Social and Cultural Origins of Egypt's Urabi Movement, Modernity and the Millennium, The Genesis of the Baha'i Faith in the 19th Century Middle East, and Sacred Space and Holy War. His blog, Informed Comment, is available at juancole.com. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's very nice to have you on, sir. Your top entries this morning seem to show the liberation of Iraq as not so liberating after all. First of all, an Iraqi blogger named Khalid apparently has been thrown in jail.
Yes, we're all very concerned for him. He's been accused of some kind of relationship to the guerrilla movement, which seems implausible to most of those of us who've read him and know his blog and those of his friends. But we've been asked by the family now to back off that for the moment and let them make their own contacts.
I see. Well, we know from what the U.S. Army admitted to the Red Cross, that up to 90% of the people that the U.S. has jailed in Iraq are innocent. So this wouldn't be an exception to that rule.
No, it would not. And this person has been jailed by the Iraqi Interior Ministry gendarmes.
I see. And also another bad news, massive suicide attacks all across Iraq yesterday. If I could just quote from your blog here. You say, when you have this kind of coordinated bomb attack in Baghdad, including attacks on U.S. convoys and even a tank, we may conclude that the U.S. military does not control the capital of the country it conquered 2 years ago. As far as I can see, the U.S. military controls little more than the ground on which they stand at any one moment, which is the goal of the guerrilla movement.
Yeah, and then the news got worse. We had enormous suicide bombing south of Baghdad late last night, and then today in Baghdad, a bomb killed 55 people in south Baghdad near a Shiite mosque in the Dura district. Single bomb.
And as you point out, this is the capital city, and it's been over 2 years since mission accomplished.
Yeah, Senator Chuck Hagel referred to Baghdad as enemy-held territory, and there's something to that.
Was it the strategy of the Iraqi government in the first place to basically just sort of give up and melt away into the civilian population to fight another day?
Well, there's some evidence that it did have those plans. The Iraqi government was ruled by the Ba'ath Party, which is was formed in Iraq in the 40s and 50s and modeled itself on Stalinist communist parties. So it has cells and it's got covert operations. And so going underground is a natural instinct for it. It has done this before.
And especially when completely overmatched with the shock and awe on the initial assault. All right, everybody, we're talking with Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. We'll be right back after this break. Scott Horton. I'm talking with Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. His site is juancole.com, the Informed Comment blog. And speaking of Informed Comment, I'm actually very curious to know what you think is the reason why the Shia in Iraq have basically just sat out this entire war. There have been a couple of exceptions with the Mahdi army under Maqtada al-Sadr. But last time that happened was a year ago, and basically the Shia are just sitting around. What are they waiting for, Mr. Cole?
Oh, they're not waiting. They're taking over. The Shia can get what they want by ordinary politics, and that's what they put their energy into.
You know, Scott Ritter said that there was fraud in the election at the end of January, and that the Shia, if they had really gotten their legitimate vote, they would have won a supermajority. But as it stood with the fraudulent tally, they at least had to form a coalition with the Kurds.
Yeah, I don't agree with Scott about that. It seems to me very clear that the election more or less represented what's really going on in Iraq pretty closely. The Shiite religious parties did win a majority in parliament. And about 14% of voters, mainly middle classes in Baghdad and Basra, voted for sort of secular Shiites. When you put the secular Shiites and religious Shiites together, you've got nearly 70% of parliament. So I think that's probably about right. But what most Americans don't realize or didn't follow was what happened in the provincial election. The nine southern provinces of Iraq all fell into the hands of the religious Shiite parties, mainly the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, places like Najaf, Karbala, Muthanna, and the Muqtada al-Sadr movement even won Maysan province. Then they also got, beyond the nine Shiite provinces, they took Baghdad. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq is in control of Baghdad City Council, or provincial council, and one other. So they basically have taken over much of the country at the provincial level, and they have a majority in parliament. They have the prime minister, they have the interior ministry, they have all kinds of important ministries, so petroleum is theirs, and so forth. So they're getting what they wanted. They have control over a budget that this year, because of petroleum prices being high, is probably going to be $20 billion. That's what they wanted. So they're getting what they wanted, and they're doing it by ordinary politics. They know that if they launch a civil war with the Sunni Arabs, that the country will fall into chaos, and that all of their political victories will come to mean nothing.
Well, there have been some who have been promoting unleashing the Badr brigades on the Sunni insurgency. In effect, didn't some of the Kurds even come out endorsing that idea?
Well, what they endorsed was combating the guerrilla movement among the Sunni Arabs with the militias that now exist, the Badr Corps and the Peshmerga among the Kurds, rather than continuing to rely primarily on the U.S. military to combat the guerrillas. Basically, the argument is that the Iraqi government's new army is still poorly trained, malformed, and won't be ready for this task for some time, but these militias are ready to go. The suggestion is not that they create a civil war on ethnic grounds, but that they use the forces that now exist to dampen down the guerrilla movement. I agree with you that there are sectarian implications to it, and it could be a bad thing. But the Iraqi Shiites have been remarkably restrained in their response to a number of massive provocations. And it's because their leadership, both religious and secular, has discouraged them from taking matters into their own hands.
Is the, you know, I'm in the middle of Texas here. I barely know anything about Islam. Is Shiite Islam a much more top-down sort of structure, where if the Ayatollah says stay home, you stay home, whereas the Sunni are kind of more loosely controlled?
Yes, in general, that's true. The ideology of Shiite Islam, as it's practiced in Iraq and Iran, is that each layperson should have a cleric that they resort to answer the more difficult questions about Islamic law and practice. They should sort of blindly obey what that cleric says, who has seminary training and years of experience and can derive what the law is from his studies from the text. And so although this system really puts the cleric in charge of ritual law and religious law, the respect that one has for him, for the Grand Ayatollah, is such that it can bleed over very easily into politics. So if he says, do something like come out and vote, then people will tend to believe that it's a religious duty to do so.
Which is what happened when he said, come out into the street and demand your right to vote.
Yes, Grand Ayatollah Sistani has been perfectly willing at times to use street protests to get his way and to force the Americans to be more democratic than perhaps they intended to. Whereas in Sunni Islam, there is no doctrine of blind imitation of clerics. Indeed, in many Sunni countries, the rank and file Muslims, fundamentalists, often have a certain amount of contempt for clerics whom they see typically as supporting the status quo and being kind of puppets of the government and so forth. So, of course, there are Sunni clerics with a great deal of respect, and there are some Sunnis who would tend to follow them. So it's not an absolute distinction, and there are Shiites who wouldn't pay too much attention to what the Grand Ayatollah says. But on the whole, by and large, the distinction you made is correct.
They say that the reason Ayatollah al-Sistani never speaks in public is because he's got a very thick Iranian accent.
Well, Grand Ayatollah Sistani's reclusiveness has been exaggerated. He does give audiences with a lot of people, and he does speak to them. It is true he has a thick Iranian accent in his Arabic, but that's not so unusual in Najaf. And having an Iranian accent has not prevented Shiite clerics from Iran who have settled in Arab countries from playing a powerful role.
He is an Arab, though, right? He's not Persian.
No, he's an Iranian.
Oh, he is
Iranian. He was born out in eastern Iran in Mashhad, near Afghanistan. Only came to Iraq late 1951 when he was about 21, and he stayed ever since. I joke with people when they ask me about this that Sistani is much more Iraqi than Schwarzenegger is Californian.
Right. Is he a higher-ranking cleric than the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran?
It's a different system.
Okay.
The simple answer to your question is yes. Sistani, in the traditional Shiite system, is much more respected and has a much higher rank as a Grand Ayatollah than Ali Khamenei in Iran. Khamenei is really more or less a politician. He is a cleric, but he got where he is for political reasons, not because of his great learning or the respect that he's held by his peers. But on the other hand, Iran has the system invented by Ayatollah Khomeini, Khamenei's predecessor, where the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the top of the government, the person who appoints the court judges, and so forth, is this religious cleric, kind of a religious theocrat. And so Khamenei has enormously more governmental power than Sistani does.
I see. It is sort of ironic, isn't it, that the United States is fighting this war to create the Islamic Republic of Iraq for a Shiite Ayatollah?
Yeah, well, of course, it's not what they were going for, but it was fairly predictable that that's what would happen. Given a vast Shiite majority and given the impact on Shiite thought and politics of Khomeini in the past 30 years, If the Shiites came to power, then they'd be very interested in somehow importing Islam in their politics. And several aides of Grand Ayatollah Sistani have said that they think it's important that Iraq be formally called the Islamic Republic of Iraq. That's going to be resisted, especially by the Kurds. It's not clear it will happen. But it's certainly the case that if things go on as they have, that we're going to end up with an Iraq that's much more deeply informed by religious law and norms than was the case under the relatively secular Ba'ath Party.
Well, you say that's not what Bush and Blair wanted. They were planning on, installing some Sunnis?
They were planning on installing secular expatriates like Ahmed Chalabi.
Right. And he is very closely related to the United Iraqi Alliance, though, isn't he?
He was the number 10 candidate. Chalabi is an operator. You know, he'll make all kinds of strange bedfellows in the course of his politics. So he's negotiated with Muqtada Sadr and the extreme Shiites. He has excellent relations with Iran. But then he represents himself as standing up for the secular Shiites. So this is somebody who butters his bread on all sides.
Yeah, and the crust, too. They now just made him the oil minister again. Okay, everybody, we're talking about the situation on the ground in Iraq with Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. His blog is juancole.com, the informed comment, and we'll be right back after this break. Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. I keep all the archives for you in MP3 format there. And also I write for antiwar.com, where I'm an assistant editor. And I'm talking with Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. His blog, Informed Comment, has the best information about what's going on in the Middle East. I recommend it to everyone. It's juancole.com, J-U-A-N-C-O-L-E. com. And we're talking about Ahmed Chalabi buttering all sides of his bread and the crust, too. And this brings up the question in my mind, sir, about whether Iran used their agent Chalabi to help lure us into Iraq. We know from Julian Borger's reporting in The Guardian that Ariel Sharon was helping with the fake information to trick the American people into the war. And we know also that Ahmed Chalabi was selling secrets to Iran, coded messages and that kind of thing. But there have been a couple of reports, I believe it was the Defense Intelligence Agency, concluded that Ahmed Chalabi was actually working for Iran in helping to lure us into Iraq in the first place. Is that your understanding, Mr. Cole?
Well, I don't think we know enough about it to conclude for sure that that's the case. First of all, a little unlikely in the sense that I don't think the Iranians really wanted 140,000 U.S. troops on their doorstep. They certainly are very happy to see Saddam overthrown, and they're happy about the Shiite majority coming to power in Iraq. And so there are real benefits to Iran of what has happened. But there are also drawbacks. There's now massive instability on their western border, and they have a superpower on their doorstep, and I really don't think they're very happy about that, so I don't think they probably would have engineered it. I think it's certainly the case that Chalabi had a strong relationship with Tehran. It does appear to be the case that he tipped the Iranians that the U.S. had broken its encryption codes and was listening to all confidential top secret Iranian internal messages. So he's done enormous damage to U.S. National security, not to mention his role in purveying false information to the U.S. government about weapons of mass destruction, connections with Al-Qaeda and so forth, which simply weren't true. But I don't think it's probably the case that that we were snookered into this war with Iraq by Iran. I don't think that George Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and others needed much snookering. I think they wanted to go to war.
Oh, no doubt about that. But we all needed snookering, and they had to get that info to snooker us from somewhere.
Yeah, well, it's true that Chalabi did provide a lot of that, but it seems really to come out of the Iraqi expatriate community.
Right. Well, when you talk about a reason that Iran would have to worry about having Americans on their doorstep, apparently there have been reports here and there, I guess particularly I'm thinking of Seymour Hersh and his article, The Coming Wars, in the New Yorker magazine a few months back, where they talk about a group called the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, and they're like communist Iranian dissidents that we're using on secret missions in Iran, something like that?
Right. Mujahideen al-Khalq, or MEK, is a cult-like organization that melds Islam and Marxism, which in the old days, the 1970s, killed U.S. troops in Iran and was part of the revolution against the Shah. But then it fell out with Khomeini and was persecuted. About 10,000 MEK were killed by Khomeini in the early 80s in Iran. And the movement went underground and it went abroad. Ultimately, it established a fighting group on Iraqi soil, which sort of makes them look like traitors or quislings, who were helping Saddam to try to destabilize Iran on behalf of the Ba'ath regime. Now, there are people in the U.S. Department of Defense who have kind of adopted the MEK now that Saddam is gone for similar purposes. A very unsavory group. The State Department considers them terrorists, but they have their defenders both in Congress and in the Department of Defense. So it may well be that that some of the bombings that have occurred in Iran were done by MEK, and indeed were tacitly done with the approval of the Department of Defense.
Well, we know now that the, I believe as Amy Goodman said, the smoking bullet in the smoking gun about the if the smoking gun memo is the gun, the bullet is the fact that American planes were literally bombing not just the no-fly zones, but really in a state of war in the fall of 2002, that the war had really already begun before Congress even passed their resolution or the Security Council passed theirs. And I think it was Scott Ritter again who wrote that we're going to find out later, you know, in history when we look back, we're going to find out that now was the time that the real war against Iran started, was we're already sending in this group that the State Department calls terrorists, and we're already sending them in to blow stuff up. We're flying drones over their country, and basically we're trying to provoke them into giving us a casus belli.
There isn't any doubt that there are powerful forces in Washington, D.C. that would very much like to overthrow the regime in Iran. In my own view, their capacity for doing so has declined over time with the quagmire in Iraq. When Saddam first fell and these neoconservatives and others were going to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, they said anyone can come to Iraq. Real men want to go to Tehran. So that was the attitude, but the reality is that Iraq just didn't go very well for the United States, and it's gotten mired in this quagmire, and the U.S. doesn't have any spare troops for Iran, which is three times as populous and a much bigger country than Iraq. There is very little that the United States can do to Iran other than bomb it. And even bombing it would enrage the religious Shiites in Iraq that have now taken over all those provinces in the south and make more trouble for the United States. So my own view is that the January 30th elections were the nail in the coffin of a forward policy by the Bush administration towards Iran. They're just not in a position to do anything.
Well, I sure hope you're right about that. There was something in Newsweek, I guess, maybe 6 months ago now, called Wargaming the Mullahs, where apparently the brass had told the neocons in the suits, forget it, pal, we're just not going to Iran. I don't care what you say, we can't.
Yeah. Well, they don't have the capacity. The United States has 10 combat divisions. A division is about 20,000 men. Most of them are, or a significant number of them, are in Iraq. Others are in Japan, South Korea, where we need them. And you can't keep them in Iraq forever. They rotate in and out. So the spare capacity that the U.S. military has of combat troops is right now zero. We simply don't have any troops for anything. And indeed, it's a little worrisome to some people in the Pentagon. You know, if trouble breaks out anywhere where the U.S. needs troops, it doesn't have any. So it can't go to Iran.
Well, let's hope that's true. apparently, you know, any attempt at some sort of color-coded revolution or something within Iran is going to be impossible.
Well, that's the other alternative. First of all, they do have excess capacity in the Air Force and the Navy. They could bomb Iran, but no bombing campaign in history has ever made any difference. They bombed Vietnam relentlessly, and it never made any difference, and so it won't make any difference in Iran either.
I think the theory they were going under in National Review was that, well, once we bomb them, then that will show the people of Iran how weak their government is, and they'll just rise up and overthrow it and become a democracy.
Yeah, well, if you go back and read the conservative magazines of the late 1960s, they were saying the same thing about North Vietnam. If only you bombed North Vietnam, the North Vietnamese would rise up and so forth. It never happened. This shock and awe campaign that they launched against Baghdad had no effect of a political nature. It never happens. They always think if they bomb a country that will change everything, but it has no impact politically. It would be the same thing in Iran. If anything, it would make the Iranian government much more popular because it would be standing up to an aggressive America. So it's just all pie in the sky. These guys, you know, have big dreams, but the reality is what we're seeing in Baghdad today, where our troops are getting blown up.
There's also been a lot of reports lately about red-on-red fighting, where the troops show up and they think they're about to be in a battle, but then they realize that the battle that's going on is between locals and foreign jihadist types.
So there was such an incident was reported out near the Syrian border. I don't think we should take that very seriously or put a lot of hopes in it. It's endemic. Anytime you have a guerrilla movement, which is various, sort of loosely connected, mainly united by its opposition to the imperial power, they will fall out from time to time. It's now forgotten that the Arab Afghans, the Arab volunteers who went to fight in Afghanistan in the 1980s, often were not liked by the local Afghans, and a lot of them got their throats slit by the Mujahideen, the Afghan holy warriors, when they weren't looking. But it didn't mean that they can't turn around and cooperate with them against the Soviets. So the same thing is true in Iraq. Occasionally these guys are going to fall out with one another. There'll be some minor incidents. But on the whole, by and large, they're willing to cooperate, even if they don't like one another, against the U.S. And I don't think we should have any hopes otherwise.
Well, it only makes sense. And from reading the book Dying to Win that I just read in the last couple of days, it sounds like you're right on the money there. That, in fact, I read a quote from Patrick Coburn. He said that the quote is always, oh, why do they kill us? We don't understand why they come and kill us when they ought to be killing the Americans. And how they ought to be killing the Americans always gets cut off at the end. And they just, in the American papers, they only show us the quote of the Iraqi complaining about the foreign fighter blowing up civilians. But they always edit the part about who they preferred would have been killed by that bomb.
Yes. Yeah, the U.S. Press is highly politicized now, and even some organizations like Knight Ridder, who have done an excellent job reporting from Iraq, now the CEO over there is making noises about the negativity of the coverage. And I don't know how you put a positive spin on a bomb that kills 85 people on a Saturday afternoon. I just don't know. And the Knight Ridder reporters are pointing this out. We don't hear the whole story over here. It's one of the reasons people come to my blog is that I will translate things from the Arabic press.
And, you know, I have something here from the New York Times, speaking of the press, and this quote just got me here. 8 months after U.S.-led siege, insurgents rise again in Fallujah. We all remember, of course, how right after the election, the back of the insurgency was broken forever by the flattening of that town. But here's a quote from Abdul Jabbar Karim Al-Awani, a 40-year-old owner of an automotive repair shop. This is from yesterday's New York Times. Some preferred the quiet city purified of the gunmen and any militant aspect. But after the unfairness and injustice with which the city's residents have been treated by American and Iraqi forces, they now prefer the resistance, just so they won't be humiliated. And that's the American strategy of winning hearts and minds in its full effect there.
Yeah, well, we should be clear that the Fallujah campaign was not about winning hearts and minds. Saddam used to have a governing technique that he called Tarhib wa Taqrib, terrorize and then bring close. So what they did in Fallujah was that same technique. They terrorized that city. They scared most people into leaving. They damaged two-thirds of the buildings in the city. They killed, I think it's 1,400 people and captured a couple thousand. And to this day, probably a good half the city is living in refugee tents or with relatives elsewhere, if not more. And the whole point of it was to demonstrate to the Sunni Arabs what's going to happen to them if they don't cut it out. It didn't work. In fact, it spread. Instability went to Mosul, where things started blowing up, and 4,000 policemen resigned. Instability spread elsewhere in the Arab areas that had been relatively quiet. Bombings went on in Baghdad and elsewhere. And now Fallujah itself has become the site of a few bomb-making factories again, despite all of the security the U.S. tried to put in. So people are just not that scared as of yet, and of course it should be remembered that Saddam's technique really only worked because he showed himself willing to gas thousands of people, which everybody knows the U.S. is not going to do.
Well, and even in the technique, as you describe, is terrorize them and then bring them close, but here we're terrorizing them and not bringing them anything.
Yeah, it is. Well, I mean, that's probably right, although I think that the intent was that you terrorize them and then you do reconstruction and hand out a lot of money and make them grateful to you.
Right,
I don't
yeah.
think the reconstruction is going very well.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure all the Fallujans who had to get their eyeballs scanned to go back to their own neighborhood are really thankful and pleased.
Yeah, and who are living in tents on the rubble of what used to be their houses.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about Kurdistan. All eyes on Kurdistan, or should be. There, if anybody in Iraq is going to break off and create a separate state and defy the authority of the central government in whatever form it eventually takes, it's going to be the Kurds. And from what I understand, there's the main controversy really is over the rich oil land near Kirkuk that Saddam Hussein imported a bunch of Arabs from more southern regions and moved them all to Kirkuk, and now the Kurds want to ethnically cleanse that city and force all the Arabs out.
Yeah, that's about the size of it.
Man, well, I was hoping you were going to tell me, no, well, it's not quite right because all these other factors that would make it less disastrous.
Yeah, a lot of the Arabs have already left, and a lot of Kurds have flooded into the city. So that process is ongoing, and I mean, I'm talking about tens of thousands of people being moved around. A lot of property disputes, and that city is a tinderbox. It's not just the Arabs and the Kurds either, because there's a very significant Turkmen population. These are people who speak a language akin to that spoken in Turkey. The ones in Kirkuk are largely Shiite. The Kurds are largely Sunni. So you have Sunni Kurds, you have Arabs, many of them Shiites brought up from the south, and then you have a Turkmen Shia. And they all don't get along. They have their own militias, and there have been street battles amongst them. There's a lot of violence in Kirkuk. It's an oil city. Whoever controls it is going to control a couple million barrels a day in petroleum, which is billions of dollars. And the Kurds very badly want that city. The Turkmen and the Arabs are determined that they not have it. And at any moment, the city could just erupt into flames.
Well, according to Cheney's oil maps that Judicial Watch got from the Freedom of Information Act, all the oil is really up in Kirkuk or it's down in the south near Basra. And I guess the question is, like, this is really part of what the Arab Sunni are fighting about, is that in the new system, they're not going to have anything. If they don't control the state, their land where they're from is nearly worthless land compared to near Kirkuk or down near Basra, right?
Yeah, at the moment, the two big fields are Kirkuk and Rumaila, and Rumaila is in the south. The Sunni Arabs don't have a big oil field. On the other hand, the Kurds and the Shiites are not demanding 100% local control of the petroleum. I think they're trying to get a quarter or so. The rest would go to Baghdad and be shared out among all the provinces. The Sunni Arabs certainly are disadvantaged by not having the petroleum field operating in their territory, but I think the petroleum politics of it would come to the fore mainly if somebody made a grab of an exclusive sort. So if the Kurds try to get Kirkuk for themselves and exclude the rest of Iraq really from any of its benefits, which could well happen. By the way, it is thought by petroleum engineers and geologists that there's a big field off of Fallujah, if only it could be developed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the Sunni Arabs could get rich if they just settle down and let the prospectors in.
Is it that they don't know that, or are they fighting about something else?
It's not mainly about the petroleum that they're fighting. It's mainly about control of the government or their place in the new Iraq.
Well, and that really is the problem that we have in post-colonial societies all around the world, right, is that the foreign elites, typically Western elites that come to create their colony, they end up favoring a minority over the majority and setting them up in power. And so then when that all falls apart, you have a majority that wants revenge, like what happened in Rwanda.
Yeah, it's very similar because it was the British who put the Sunni Arabs, or continued the Sunni Arabs in control of Iraq after they had grown up in control under in the Ottoman period, despite the Shiite majority. The British set a tone set a system that went on to dominate Iraq for the rest of the 20th century.
In the new system, the constitution that's being written now, do you think it's going to be a strong central state that they're all going to fight, bloody battles over? Or is there a possibility that maybe they'll make the central government weak enough that it's not really worth killing each other over?
Well, I think both the Kurds and the Shiites can agree that they want a federal state. The Kurds would like it to be a much weaker federal state than the Shiites. Shiites will accept a federalism, but they want a U.S.-style federalism where the federal government, central government, is pretty powerful. The Kurds really want, I think, something more like Switzerland, where you have cantons and the federal government too much except foreign affairs and so forth. The Sunni Arabs want straight central rule. They reject federalism altogether. They want something like France, where everything from Paris. And so the three of them each has a different view of the future of Iraq, and that dispute is now being played out in the committee that's writing the permanent constitution, and they're hung up over the first sentence in the constitution, which declares Iraq a federal state. And the Arabs are digging in their heels and saying, no, we don't want a federal state, we want a centralized state.
How many Sunnis do they even have taking part in drawing up the Constitution?
Well, the parliamentary committee that's drawing up the Constitution is 55 members, of which only two are Sunni Arabs, in accordance with their proportion in the parliament as a whole. But a compromise was worked out whereby another 23 members were appointed. A lot of them don't have real voting rights, but they do have a voice. So the Sunni Arabs are now fairly well represented on that committee, probably even above their proportion in the population. But they're not mostly voting members. On the other hand, I think everybody knows it's dangerous for the Shiites and the Kurds just to walk all over them and outvote them. They'll strive to reach some kind of consensus.
The former Prime Minister Alawi, he has said in the last week that this is the start of civil war, that if we don't bring in a bunch more American troops and a bunch more billions of American dollars, that the whole game is up and it's going to fall apart. Is he just greedy and using his own ends, or is that, you think, an honest assessment of the situation?
In a way, I think it's both. That is to say, anybody with eyes to see can see that Iraq has fallen into a kind of unconventional civil war. And Alawi is correct that this thing is going to hell in a handbasket. On the other hand, we don't have more troops to send to Iraq, so his idea that there's more should be sent just isn't going to work out very well. It's not clear that sending more troops to Iraq would, in fact, resolve any big problems, since the guerrilla movement is fighting against an American occupation. It might well increase its political salience to send more troops. And see, Alawi himself was shoehorned into a position as interim prime minister by the United States, the United Nations, and would very much like to get back into power if he could. So his desire for a very strongly American-dominated Iraq is probably a sign that he thinks that he could ride such a phenomenon back to power as prime minister.
Right, he's been our guy for a while, right?
Yeah, he broke with Saddam in the 70s, and they tried to kill him, and he became an expert in organizing the ex-Baath officers who broke with Saddam. Whenever they broke with Saddam and they had to run away from Iraq to London, Alawi would contact them and get them together into a clique that hoped to overthrow Saddam. So then he hooked up with the CIA, especially in the 90s. So he's been an American asset for a long time and is associated with that group of Iraqis who are ex-Baathists, who used to be Baath, members of the Baath Party, but broke with it, and who are more secular and nationalistic in their attitude and less religious. And they really lost the elections on January 30th. That group, they got 14%.
They got 14, is that what I said?
1-4.
This is the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. His blog is called Informed Comment and is available at juancole.com. And who else do you write for on a regular basis, Mr. Cole?
I write pretty regularly for Salon.com, and I publish op-eds all over the place. I've been in the Washington Post, the L.A. Times, a lot of different places, the Guardian.
All right, everybody. I'm Scott Horton, and talking with Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, and we'll be right back after this break to wrap up, talk a little bit of exit strategy from Iraq. Be right back.
Take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Billy. Don't take your guns to town.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan, where he teaches modern Middle East and South Asian history. And his blog is called Informed Comment. It's at juancole.com. And I want to talk to you a little bit about exit strategy, Professor Cole. I forget who it was, a guest on the show a couple of weeks ago, quoted a letter writer to the New York Times as saying, "It's time to cut and walk," which doesn't quite sound so bad as cut and run. What do you say?
Well, it's a problem. The Bush administration has got the United States stuck in Iraq, and there's no good solution. I worry about just up and leaving, because I think it's certainly the case that were the United States to do that, Iraq would fall into a hot civil war. And it wouldn't stay in Iraq. If you had Sunni Arabs massacring Shiites, the Iranians would come in to support the Shiites. If you had Shiites massacring Sunni Arabs, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Iranian Sunnis would come in. If Kirkuk exploded and you had Kurdish massacres of Turkmen, the Turks would come in the north. So it would turn into a regional war with a strong guerrilla war aspect to it. And if that happened, the whole region could be destabilized. And the guerrillas, one of their tools is petroleum pipeline sabotage. So you could end up with Iranian facilities being sabotaged by Sunni Arabs, to end up with Shiites sabotaging Saudi pipelines. Now, most Americans don't realize this, but two-thirds of the proven petroleum reserves in the world are in the Persian Gulf region, and a very great deal of the petroleum available for export is there. 80 million barrels a day are produced. The Saudis do about 9 million of that. So if, and the Iranians do 4, if you took the Iranians and the Saudis off the market, you'd have maybe $20 a gallon gasoline. And it would deindustrialize the world. It would throw you into severe economic depression.
Well, I mean, all that sounds really bad, but I wonder if the American presence there can prevent all this, or whether this just whether our troops there just make all this more likely to be the end result when we finally do leave.
No, as long as the troops are there, they can't have the scenario I'm talking about. I personally agree with you that American rules of engagement, the military tactics of the U.S. probably make things worse rather than better. But it should be remembered that the Sunni Arab guerrillas who are fighting, engaging in most of the violence, have targeted Shiite civilians in large numbers. It's not just the Americans fighting. They're also fighting the new Shiite political class. And they would kill it. They'd just take Ibrahim Jaffari and Ayatollah Sistani and others. They just take them out and shoot them at the Americans right there. So it's not easy just to get up and leave.
Right. Well, but I just wonder, I mean, if we leave 10 years from now, we're still going to be facing the same problem, right? I mean, at one point, we just kind of got to...
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the hope is that over time, you would grind the guerrilla resistance down. I mean, these things don't last forever. I'm not advocating that myself. I think the problem should be internationalized, although I recognize the Bush administration is probably not going to do that, and it's going to be really difficult to convince anybody else to help out.
Right. Well, and I wish we had time to discuss that, but we're all out of it. I want to thank you very much for your time today, Professor Cole.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. And we'll be right back, everybody, with Robert A. Pape, author of Dying to Win. Check out Juan Cole's blog, Informed Comment, at juancole.com.